Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I'm your host, Todd Embley. And in part two of our interview with EIU economist Tianchen Xu, we turn our focus to the Chinese consumer. Is spending recovering? What's happening in the housing market? And are the big headline sales events like 618 masking deeper issues in consumer confidence? Tianchen walks us through the mixed signals emerging from China's domestic economy, from retail sales rebounds to the drag of the property sector. He also explains the broader social and psychological drivers behind current consumption behavior and what he expects for the rest of the year. Enjoy.
So first, China isn't as bad as they think, and they're pessimists. Is pretty much overdone. Let's say an example is China has been experiencing, as we just talked about, China has been experiencing a significant property correction. Yeah, but its overall economic performance has very much held up. And for example, exports did well, manufacturing did well, consumer market, as we talk about, was decent. Even if we had this property correction, we are not experiencing mass bankruptcies among banks or, let's say, massive bankruptcies among households. They didn't happen. In China, there are still social stability and prices are being affordable. There's no cost of living pressures.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation. Brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Let's talk about China in of itself. Let's talk about consumer sentiment. Now, how healthy is consumer sentiment in China right now in general, and also based on retail growth and survey data that you have?
The overall sentiment is decent. I mean, based on my role as an economist, but also as a resident in China. Yeah, it is not as bad as many suggest. So let's look at some data points, for example.
And it depends who suggests. Like, that's the thing. Everybody wants to try to say something negative about China because they always want to make China look less or in trouble, or they're going to get it. And they're never right. And it's never true. But they keep trying. And we won't even get into why. But it's never true. Go ahead.
Yes. It is not to say that we are free from any challenges in terms of
the, sure.
Yeah, consumer consumption landscape. Yeah. But I would say that evidence points to, let's say, more on the positive side than on the negative side. Yeah. And for example, retail growth in May, it grew by 6.4%. Yeah. So, and that is the growth of value. And we know that prices in China are generally falling. Yeah. So that means in terms of what we economically called real growth. Yeah. Or let's say for us to understand easier, volume growth, it will be even higher. Let's say at maybe 8 to 9%. Yeah, and I think that is actually pretty good. People are at least willing to purchase more mobile phones, TV sets, other sort of home appliance. Yeah. And based on some holiday spending data and people, they are spending, they are going on more trips in those holidays. Yeah. And what else I can say is that people react very positively to the consumer subsidy program. Yeah, because one news I guess many of you guys are aware of is that governments, they ran out of subsidies in many places by mid-June. Yeah. And for most of the goods, it is not that the governments, they are subsidizing 1% of the goods of value. They're not giving it for free. They're just providing subsidies at 20% of the goods value. Yeah, and the consumers still needs to pay 80%. That means the bigger burden still lies with consumers. Yeah, and in that context, the government ran out of subsidies. And that means even the governments, they are probably underestimating of, I mean, how passionate Chinese consumers are about those consumer subsidies, or let's say taking advantage of the government money to buy something. Yeah, and I find it found it very, very impressive. Yeah, so I think let's look at things from another angles. So in our engagement with clients, we generally identify, let's say, there are three stages of the recovery in consumption. So one is the first stage is people save, they do not spend. The second stage is people spend out of their income, but they do not borrow. Three, people borrow to spend. So right now, I think we are at stage two. Yeah, we generally see the first stage during COVID. Yeah, people, they are very uncertain about their future, the economy, and the disruptions of the pandemic. Yeah, so they are more inclined to save. Yeah, and it is still rather the case over the large part of 2023 after China's COVID reopening. Yeah, we have seen from a macro data a huge rise in terms of consumer household deposits. Yeah. But right now, if we look at, macroeconomic data, and people, they are spending a larger share of their income. Yeah. But also, when we look at the credit data, the loans to the household sector, the loans to businesses, and the applications for consumer borrowings, then the overall data is still quite poor. Yeah, so people do not have a strong appetite for borrowing to spend. Yeah, so we probably need some further, let's say, recovery or a further improvement of the economy, yeah, to see people, let's say, to see the rise in terms of the so-called animal spirit of the people. Yeah, if they have enough animal spirit, then they will increase their borrowing from the banks. Yeah, and they are probably more eager to buy housing, yeah, and they are probably more, let's say, aggressive about using their credit cards. Yeah, so I think that's the general assessment of the consumer landscape right now.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about housing in a second, but I first want to talk a little bit about maybe your opinion on what sectors are showing like the strongest resilience or have the best growth outlook for the second half of 2025.
Yeah, I would say I would generally classify them into maybe two different parts. One is related to innovation. From the example of DeepSeek let's say the emergence of other, made in China technologies, we are, I think I'm pretty much optimistic about the future, the near-term and the long-term future of Chinese innovation. After AI, you are going to see, say, pharma, medical devices, semiconductors, that are all going to perform very well, I think, in the second half of this year. Based on companies' financial reports, financial filings, they have already, let's say, in the stage of we have to spend large capex to fund our R&D to really, producing some outcomes, especially financially. A lot of such companies, they are making profits, and they are gaining more market share, in the domestic or the global markets. These, let's say, general innovation-driven sectors, so they are having still very huge room to for growth, and that is to be sure. And the second is things related to deregulation. And that means, for most types of areas, China still maintain a lot of entry barriers or let's say regulations, and that is for sure. There are some areas where China is quietly deregulating. For example, tutoring sector. It was the subject of a very very severe crackdown in 2021. And a lot of people in that sector, they lost their jobs, they moved to elsewhere, and they have to, let's say, turn underground, for example. But right now, this year, and maybe last year, we have been looking at spotting signals of the tutoring sector is coming back. I would say that tutoring is the new finance. What does that mean? Finance used to be the sector attracting the best talents in China. For example, from Tsinghua, from a university, for example. We know that the financial sector, financial services sector, it is, under some sort of a crackdown right now. Salary cuts. More, let's say, regulatory oversight. As a result, the financial sector is no longer hugely attractive to new graduates. So guess where do those top tier talents go? They're going to tutoring. They're becoming the teachers of the private tutoring institutions.
We have a saying in English. They say, those that can't do, teach.
And this is because then the sector is no longer subject to very strict regulations. And we can think about if there are any other places where the deregulation will probably encourage growth. I guess video games might be one of them. And some maybe other, let's say, tech related. So the government is generally, relax its curbs on the development of big tech firms. So these might be the areas that could be seeing the greatest level of resilience or better growth outlook.
Tianchen, the one thing I want you to tell me is when I'm going to be able to open my BYD dealership in Canada. That's what I want to do. And then I'll open also like a Xiaomi EV dealership as well. I want to be able to be a dealer for those EVs in Canada. That's really, gosh, that would be so amazing. Sorry, I watch way too many Instagram videos that talk about how amazing the EVs are in China. And I just really, really wish I could have one over here. Now, we are going to talk about the housing market. I kind of look forward to this topic conversation because I was in China, as listeners know, from, let's say, 2008, end of 2007 through 2016. Those were the booming years. I would watch 20, 30,000 person complexes rise from the ground within a couple of years and on the ocean. Amazing amenities, just absolutely incredible palaces, really. And then some of them just ended up being ghost towns. And it was kind of sad to see because they were truly unbelievable. How has the weakness in the housing market affected consumer confidence? How closely do consumers think about and let the housing market condition affect their confidence, their spending, their habits? Maybe there is no correlation whatsoever. And are there reasons to believe that the property sector will improve?
Yeah, I think it is probably the number one question people will ask for China's economy.
Okay, let's start there. Why do people, and I mean, this is a very Western thing, right? This, I mean, you go back, whether it's Trump or Robert Kiyosaki or whomever, property has been the king of wealth. Generational wealth has come from land and or building. Is that why the West cares so much about the housing market in the East?
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the reasons. Yeah, but I would also like to say that, I mean, every property downturn has caused a lot of economic damages, regardless of where it took place.
Every country,
yeah. And the lessons of the global financial crisis, which is which originates from a housing downturn, yeah, it's still pretty much fresh in our mind. Yeah, so I'm not surprised that people will be interested in how will China's current housing stress will go, right? Yeah, so basically, I think there are two questions: how it is affecting consumer confidence, and when it will improve. So the first question is, I think, yes, we should acknowledge that the housing market downturn does hit consumers. It is no exception in China, because about 60% of China's household wealth is tied to the housing market. Yeah, and that is the percentage several years ago. Yeah, and the percentage might have come down because of the shrinkage, the shrinking in the market value of China's housing. Yeah, but it is still a very large part of China's household wealth. So let me explain what factors affect consumer confidence the most. I would say not the magnitude of price decline, yeah, but the share of property in your assets, yeah, and the debt levels undertaken by homeowners, yeah. So that's why you see the consumer landscape in Beijing and Shanghai underperforming. Yeah, and I think at least from 2024. Yeah, because in these cities, a higher level of wealth is tied to the property, and the mortgage burden is very high. But the reason is very simple: because the home prices are higher, less affordable. Yeah, so you need more borrowing. Yeah. So As a result, even if the price declines in Beijing and Shanghai are lesser than those in small cities, they are having a disproportionate impact on consumer sentiment. Yeah. So as we remember, retail growth is 6.4% in May. Yeah, and it is four to 5% growth in the first half of this year, which is decent. Yeah, but what about in Beijing? The retail sales fell by 3.1%. Yeah, and Shanghai, it's just about stagnant. Yeah, so if we look at other cities, maybe like Chongqing is growing at 4 to 5%. Yeah, and some other second-tier cities like my hometown, Hefei in Anhui, yeah, it is also growing by a medium pace. Yeah, other second-tier cities, yeah, they are overperforming Beijing and Shanghai. Yeah, so in these cities, the home price declines are even sharper. Yeah, for example, in Hefei, some of the home prices, they declined by 30% or 40%. Yeah, but the retail sales, they're doing just about good. This is because people, they are not borrowing a lot to fund their home purchase. Yeah, or in another way, the equity, the LTV, the loan to value ratio is very low. Yeah, and as a result, people's spending power are not hit that hard during the current housing downturn. Yeah, and regarding your second question, when or if the property sector will improve, so based on international comparison, the price decline in the property downturn ranges from 20% to 40%. Yeah, in China's case, the price has fallen by a similar range. For example, in Beijing, most of the places in Beijing, the prices should have fallen by, let's say, 20% or around that. Yeah, but in some smaller cities, yeah, you could probably have seen around 40 to 50%. Yeah, so I think at this stage, we are near the bottom. Yeah, if the examples of other countries can serve as a useful reference. Yeah, and you could probably see that the overall housing market will stabilize in the next year. Yeah, and after that, housing price will stabilize as a reasonable level. And for example, when you measured the house price to rent ratio or the house price to income ratio, yeah, they will become, let's say, more reasonable. Yeah, and after that, if let's say the average Chinese household income can rise at a moderate level, then I believe that there is a good chance of housing prices rising in line with that income growth. Yeah, and lastly, I think also in based on international comparison, an average housing downturn lasts for, let's say, an average of 6 years. Yeah, if I remember it correctly. And in China, it started from 2021. Yeah, and right now we are entering the fifth year of that downturn. Yeah, and probably, let's say, if the average 6 years can be a good reference, then 2026 should be the year of bottoming out.
So you and I are going to buy an investment property together. We should have done it last year. We should do it this year, or we should do it next year. What do you think?
Yeah, I think probably next year, because this year, I mean, there is still some uncertainties related to the housing market, because over the past 2 years, past 2 months, we have seen some softness re-emerging in the market. Yeah, and to be honest, I myself is selling a property. Yeah, and the broker has been telling me the market these weeks is not getting good. It might be going down in the next few couple of months. Yeah, so
take it off the market.
Sorry,
would you take it off the market, or would you just let it let yourself see what happens?
Yes, I would prefer, let's say, wait. Yeah, if the market goes down in the next couple of months, I'll probably prefer taking a wait and see approach. Yeah, and let's wait for the next year. Yeah, because I truly believe that the bottom is not far away from us.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you've won the lottery. Congratulations. You can choose anywhere in China to live, and you get to take all of your family and all of your friends, all of your loved ones with you, but you cannot stay in your hometown. But then you could also buy a place in which to invest anywhere in China. So where would you want to move and where would you want to invest? Name two cities. One is for life and one is for money.
Yeah, very, very good question. So for life, I probably need to decide between maybe two or three cities. Yeah. So,
sure. Name them. Yeah, go ahead. Make it easy.
Yeah, because they have their, respect advantages, pros and cons.
Yeah. Why am I asking an economist for a quick answer? I don't know.
Yeah, but just to be short, Suzhou and Chongqing.
Chongqing, okay. Yeah, Suzhou. Isn't that like the most populated city in China?
Yes. But also because it has a very expensive, administrative area. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. And the third one?
Third one, I don't know, probably just these two. How about that?
Yeah? No. Hainan, Sanya, Xiamen, no, nothing tropical?
No, tropical, but also part due to some personal preference. We don't like weather that is too humid.
Yeah, I know. I hear you. Yeah. Okay. For investment.
Okay, for investment.
Just pure investment. You don't have to live there.
Chengdu.
Ah, Chengdu. Okay. Yes. Sichuan province.
Yeah. Or if choose between two, Chengdu or Shanghai.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. I used to live in Shanghai. So on the Puxi side, of course. Those foreigners all the foreigners could go to Pudong. I prefer the Puxi. I digress. Okay. Thank you for taking that up. Now, we talked about this a little bit, about the pessimism among overseas observers. I wanted to put that question maybe a different way and say, what are they getting wrong? When they have that pessimistic tone when writing and or speaking about China, what are they missing? What are they getting wrong? Or what are they not understanding when they do that?
Yeah, I think there are, let's say, two dimensions of that. So first, China isn't as bad as they think, and their pessimism is pretty much overdone. Let's say an example is China has been experiencing a significant property correction. Yeah, but its overall economic performance has very much held up. And for example, exports did well, manufacturing did well. Yeah, and consumer market, as we talk about, was decent. Yeah, and even if we had this property correction, we are not experiencing, let's say, mass bankruptcies among banks or, let's say, massive bankruptcies among households. Yeah, so they didn't happen. And we still, in China, there are still social stability. Yeah, and prices are being affordable. There's no cost of living pressures. Yeah. And I don't think that, I mean, foreign observers, I don't think they can observe these sort of stuff if they don't come to China.
Yeah.
Even if, only if you come to China, you can realize, let's say, how affordable things are here now, and probably how advanced are the modern infrastructure. Yeah, the high speed trains. Yeah. And I think that's the first part. And the second part is, say, how China compares to other countries. Yeah, because, I mean, in these turbulent times, every country has its own challenges. China has its own challenges. For example, the, let's say, maybe overinvestment, the property stuff. Yeah, and some, and of course, externally, the tariffs, but so do other countries. Yeah, for example, Europe is struggling with its broader competitiveness bottleneck. Yeah, which Mario Draghi pointed out in his very lengthy report. And then in the US, there's the cost of living pressures. Yeah, and in that sense, China, at least, I think it is providing something very attractive. Yeah, apart from what I've talked about, China offers long-term policy stability. It doesn't need to adopt a very, you know, populist policies. Yeah, you don't need to cater to your voters, but rather than you can be fixated on your long-term objectives. Yeah, and that is, I think, that is making China relatively successful over the past decade. Yeah, and of course, there are some other thing that China is attractive, a huge market, for example. Yeah, and I think in addition, I also strongly encourage people to go beyond the biggest cities to China. I strongly encourage people to go beyond the biggest cities in China to the so-called second tier and third tier cities. Yeah, because compared to Beijing, for example, they are more vigorous. Yeah, and hosts better infrastructure. Yeah, and their overall economic growth is actually faster than those very mature biggest cities. Yeah, and even in some places, you can you have a futuristic sense. Yeah, in terms of, let's say, experiencing the driverless taxis in Wuhan, for example. So I think overall you really need to be in China to really rectify or to recalibrate your view on China.
Yeah, I just don't think you should. I honestly don't think you should have a view at all. It used to drive me crazy, and this is a little bit of my PTSD from the tech sector. So when I worked for China Accelerator and I was working for the fund, at that time, everybody was so eager to try to figure out what was going on in China tech, right? It was the startup days, venture, you know, VC was going wild, Tencent and Alibaba and Baidu and the rest were just, you know, springing up. They were on the tips of everybody's tongue in Silicon Valley. And these publications, these journals would send people out and they would do this tech tour of China. They would spend maybe 2-3 weeks going to some events and touring the different cities. And they would go to Beijing and they would go to Shanghai and they would go to Guangzhou and they would go to Shenzhen. And then they would go home and they would write these long self-perceived masterpieces on everything that was happening in tech in China. And it would make me cringe. I couldn't stand it. Mostly, they got it completely wrong. It was mostly fluff. It was published by everybody. It drove me nuts. They had no true actual idea. You cannot do that. China is not somewhere. If you're English speaking and you go somewhere else that's English speaking and you spend a few weeks there, you can probably write something akin to the truth about that place. But China is not that place. You cannot truly understand the cultural layers and the differences that they have, the decades and centuries of a different type of rule, of a different type of society that is built on completely different foundations. And to sit outside the country and try to read a minimum of publications and data and try to prognosticate about the truth about what is there, or to even present it as somewhere even close to the truth, to me is ridiculous. And that is why we have this podcast, so that you can get actual truth from people like Tianchen. Thank you. Now, moving on, what are your thoughts on Canada-China relations under my new PM, Mark Carney?
So before talking about Mark Carney, let's probably talk about Justin Trudeau, because
do we really have to?
Yeah, let's make some comparison, right?
So yes,
in China's view, Trudeau is just openly siding with the U.S. And there was a lot of, you know, policy coordination, such as EV tariffs, which made China very unhappy. Yeah. So, but why is that? I mean, I don't think there's absolutely any need to charge Chinese EVs with 100 tariffs. Yeah. And Canada is not a major producer of EVs, right? And it is not in a strategic competition with China. Yeah. So there should be, let's say, more trade rather than more, let's say, more fights. Yeah. So that is one thing. I'm not.
You're preaching to the choir, buddy. I've already talked about I want my dealerships.
Yeah. Hope you can open a dealership under Mark Carney. Yeah. But anyway, I think Mark Carney, we need to look at him differently. So first, I think he's not such a figure. He's not aligning himself very closely with the U.S. Yeah. And that is probably leading to some trade spats between the U.S. and Canada right now. Yeah. But regarding the current direction of travel, I think the outlook is quite mixed. Yeah. So definitely it is not going to hell. Yeah. But it is not going to heaven either. So Carney, I think he made the positive step in sending the message about repairing ties with China. Yeah. And they also talk about regularizing communications, right? And that, I think, at one stage, created a lot of optimism about the future direction of travel between Canada and China. But then there's the ban on Hikvision on some national security reasons. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is, I can probably think of where Canada comes from. Yeah, because there tends to be, let's say, some controversies around the Hikvision or maybe Huawei here and there. Yeah, but I mean, if Mark Carney really wants to repair the ties with China, to regularize communication, then I think he has some better way to do that, to approach that. For example, let's maintain some, informal behind the scenes communications. Yeah. On why is the controversy about Hikvision? Yeah. And how the two countries can find a solution. For example,
I mean, it's not that hard. Politicians are simply driven by whatever public sentiment is. They will prostitute themselves to public opinion. That's really mostly what they do. So if I'm Mark Carney, I'm almost telling China, hey, can you do something about my country's opinion about this? produce something, do something, make it easy for me to take your side. Because as long as most people in Canada have and hold a certain opinion about this company, about this product, about something, I am bound because they put me in power and I would like to stay in power. So I kind of have to just defend what they think outwardly. So I have to do this kind of thing. You know, if you do something to make them not mad about that, then I will totally come back to you.
Yes, yes. Because what he is approaching this stuff is not leading to a peaceful resolution, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Cardi wants good trade, but he wants his power more.
Yes. Yeah, so that is sort of complicating things, and I think because he's just several months into his premiership, right, and he needs to probably, I think, set a good positive foundation for how the bilateral ties will go. Yeah, and I also have the feeling, I mean, from a Chinese angle, that and I also heard some other people talking about Carney. Like labeling him as probably the newest representative of the Western values. Yeah, because clearly Trump is not somebody you can count on if for representing the Western values. Yeah, and the EU,
or any values.
Yes, it is sort of somewhat struggling. Yeah, and Mark Carney, because he has been both served in Bank of England. He has served in the he's currently serving the Canadian government. Yeah, and he's probably being seen as a figure trying to uniting the Western countries across the Atlantic. Yes, and that probably means in his engagement with China, he will inevitably raise something around values, right? In terms of probably the liberal values, human rights, yeah, and probably countering China's influence. Yeah, if we look at the joint communique from the G7 meeting, I think they wrote something around countering China's influence into that. Yeah, so it is probably not very constructive. Yeah, and the two nations should manage that very carefully.
I agree wholeheartedly. It's not a cultural symbiosis between the two countries, for sure.
Right.
But I agree. I heard Jordan Peterson, who people can make their own opinion about, on Joe Rogan, someone else people can make their own opinion about, saying something early on that Trump made one of his biggest errors when he was talking about Canada becoming the 51st state, simply because he took the Liberal Party out of the ashes of the previous, you know, three terms, and its economic poor showing, and helped Carney win the election because it's a big mistake for Trump, because Carney is probably Trump's most seasoned and most well-connected adversary now in the West. And he was literally individually responsible for helping make that happen. Gifted Mark Carney the premiership. Honestly, sometimes I can't decide if Trump is smart or crazy or idiotic or all of them mixed. I really cannot tell you. Any final thoughts, Tianxin, on international companies regarding risk or opportunities in China? And may I give a precursor to your answer? Because if you read pessimistic remarks, and if you think there is risk, or if there is downturn in the economy still to come, or if there is a lack of consumer confidence in your sector and X and Y and Z, remember Warren Buffett's investing style or mantra: when everybody goes right, I go left. And I would absolutely use every piece of naive sentiment that talks about it as a bad place to invest to my advantage as an early mover advantage to go get in, get set up, already be successful by the time everybody else figures it out. Okay, your thoughts.
I mean, I won't deny that. I mean, geopolitics is holding back international companies. I mean, ever since probably 2022, when they make investments or business plans. Yeah, but I think that's, it's a good time to be contrarian. Yeah, because risks are maybe high-ish. Yeah, but the rewards could be even higher. Yeah, and the trophies will be a lot. Yeah, yeah. But I would need to say that, I mean, it is not the way before, in the, because EIU as a company in with operations in China, we have, you know, prior to 2023, we have served mostly for foreign enterprises exploring Chinese opportunities. Over the past two decades, yeah, we have been doing this for so long, yeah, and it is no doubt that China offered a lot of you know, consumer or industry opportunities for foreign firms, yeah. But right now and going forward, I think the mode of interactions will be different, yeah. So I'll probably say three things. First, I mean, opportunities are abundant in China. I mean, at least in non-sensitive areas. For example, I think Sam's Club is a very good example. It is even from an adversary country, from America, right? Yeah, but it's making huge success.
And it's not even that popular in the US anymore. Hasn't been exactly. For so long, like a decade or more.
Exactly.
Millennials probably don't know what Sam's Club is.
Yes. I've never been to the Sam's Club in the New York suburban areas.
I've been to Sam's Club in China, though.
Yes, I'm a member of that.
Yeah, I was too.
So can you believe that? Sam's Club has already opened 6 stores in Beijing alone. Yeah, and I think it is probably... Has operations in every of Chinese top-tier cities, Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, and Guangzhou. Yeah, and it is starting to opening stores in second-tier cities, the major provincial capitals, and maybe other cities like Suzhou or Qingdao. Yeah, so it is a huge success. Yeah, and... So it is, of course, operating in the consumer segment, right? Yeah, and I think the like Chinese consumers, yes, like in Costco. Yeah, but Costco is sort of probably less successful compared to Sam's Club in China. Or it is not making such aggressive moves in China. Yeah, but it can try so. Yeah, and but I mean, a lot of opportunities for the consumer business. Yeah, there's the supermarket. Yeah, but also let's say some other let's say daily goods or even let's say leisure goods, baby dolls. And of course food and drinks. Yeah, and I think there are countless of successful examples in of foreign brands being successful in China. Yeah, and they are not getting replaced by domestic alternatives. Yeah, so that's the first thing. And the second thing is foreign companies can also learn from what's happening in China and probably get inspirations. Yeah, for example... I lived in New York for a couple of years, but I spent more time in China, of course. So What I'm pretty impressed is that, I mean, we already have, you know, same day delivery or next day delivery. Yeah. In terms of, Jingdong, yeah, or in the United States, example, you have, Amazon Prime. Yeah. Which is good enough. But right now, the new battleground in China is what we call instant retail. Yeah. So just get things delivered in 30 minutes. Delivery, for example, buying a phone, and they're delivering a phone like delivering a lunch. Yeah, so isn't that crazy, right?
Yeah, I'll race it to the front door.
Yes, and this is not completely based on, let's say, cheap labor. Yeah, China's labor is not, it's no longer very cheap, right? Yeah, but it is also about how companies, how big platforms, they organize the operations, how to make operations more efficient. Yeah, so I think that is a very, very impressive. Yeah, and third, I think there's the next big phenomenal opportunities, which lies in Chinese companies going global. Yeah, so many Chinese companies, they are going global. Yeah, this is echoed by macroeconomic indicators. Yeah, if you look at the Chinese Ministry of Commerce statistics, the overseas outbound investment, it is growing and every year. Yeah, so why? So what are the opportunities? I mean, for let's say other international or foreign firms. Yeah, so I think first it is reorganizing supply chains in places outside of China. Yeah, for example, China. I think the iPhone supply chain is a very good example where iPhone has been successfully creating a supply chain out of China, which consists of both Chinese firms, yeah, and non-Chinese firms. Yeah, Chinese firms do air pieces, do some other components. Yeah, but for example, the displays, they are produced by Samsung or other, let's say, non-Chinese companies. Yeah, so that's the first area. The second area is about providing services to them. Yeah, because Chinese firms, as they go global, they are learning by doing. Yeah, and it is fair to say they are still being quite inexperienced. Yeah, and one thing is that they haven't been able to utilize those services, professional services, very well. Yeah, for example, hiring some firms to do business development, helping and using some firms as their legal advisor or as their, let's say, a regional intelligence provider. Yeah. And I don't think Chinese companies have invested nearly enough. Yeah. And, but as they move outside and they have, and they embark on global expansion, they'll come to realize that we do really need this. Yeah. And, I think in that area, Western firms, the Western professional services providers, they're still very experienced and they're having a competitive edge. Yeah. And, and I'm sure they will probably, get massive deals on that front.
I'll give you a hot tip. You know how I save 20 to 25% on all of my Sony TVs because Sony makes the best TVs. You know how I save 20-25% on every single one? It's because I buy TCL and Hisense, because I'm telling you, I've got seven of them. I've got three at my office and four in my house, and they are as good. The picture quality is as good. The sound quality is as good. They last as long, and I get a 20-25% discount because they simply don't have the name Sony on the front of the TV. But I'm telling you what, that is the best bang for your buck in the market today when it comes to TVs. And I will enjoy that discount for as long as I can get it. Tianchen Xu, Senior China Economist at the Economist Intelligence Unit, thank you very, very much for coming on the show. In the two parts, the three parts, the eight parts that we turn this into, you gave us loads and loads of time and even more in expert advice and intelligence. Congratulations on the birth of your new baby girl. Welcome to fatherhood. And thank you very, very much for coming on our show. We really, really appreciate it.
Thanks, Todd. It's a great pleasure to talk to you. Yeah, and hope our voice can be heard by more and more people. I mean, both in China and across the globe.
Agreed. Agreed. Thank you very much again. Okay. Thanks very much for listening, everybody. Don't forget, we have the YouTubes over on the WPIC YouTube channel. If you have any advice for us, any tips, any comments, any guest recommendations, you can always reach out to us at podcast@WPIC.co. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, hit that little button. It really kind of helps us get our show in front of more people. But from me, from Tianchen, and from everybody at the Negotiation family and team, thank you very much for listening and or watching, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@WPIC.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.